Today is Tuesday, November 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. President-elect Joe Biden issued a warning Monday.
More people may die.
Plus, the world is battling more than just the coronavirus.
As the pandemic continues, people are having difficulty maintaining safe habits.
And Peru's new president.
Peru's Congress voted in legislator and engineer Francisco Sagasti as Peru's interim president to defuse a political crisis ahead of national elections in April.
We'll have these stories and more next. President-elect Joe Biden is warning of potentially deadly consequences as the Trump administration refuses to coordinate with his transition team on the coronavirus pandemic. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani is up first.
They were Biden's toughest comments yet on the president's failure to acknowledge he lost the election and to cooperate with Biden's staff.
More people may die if we don't coordinate.
Saying his team needs to know the administration's plans to control the pandemic and distribute prospective vaccines.
What's the game plan?
The Trump administration's been working on its own distribution plan, and some Republicans like Senator Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski say it's crucial Biden's team get full access. Biden says it's great that two prospective vaccines are showing promise in fighting the virus, but
it's of little use until you're vaccinated.
He's blasting the president for not allowing the Biden transition team access to plans for distributing the vaccine to all Americans.
It's a huge, huge, huge undertaking.
And says if his team has to wait until it takes office,
it puts us behind over a month, month and a half.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
With the country seeing a surge in coronavirus cases, the leaders of California, Iowa, and other U.S. states are imposing new restrictions to try to slow the spread of the virus, which has killed more than 247,000 people in the United States. As the world grapples with more than 55 million confirmed cases and over 1.3 million deaths from COVID-19, many countries are instituting stricter measures to try curbing its spread. Austria has entered a partial lockdown that will be in effect until at least December 6th, where only essential shops like supermarkets, butchers, pharmacies, and bakeries will be allowed to operate. Non-essential businesses like restaurants, bars, sports facilities, and hair salons will remain closed. Officials in South Korea said that they will elevate physical distancing rules in the greater Seoul area and in some parts of the eastern Gangwon province to try and suppress the coronavirus resurgence. While South Australian officials are warning that they face a dangerous situation. Phil Mercer reports that Western Australia, Tasmania, and the Northern Territory are reintroducing quarantine measures on South Australian residents.
After 7 months with no community transmission of the new coronavirus, South Australia is fighting to contain a cluster of new cases. Most of the recently detected infections are within the same family. The source is thought to have been a hotel in Adelaide, where Australian travellers are placed in mandatory quarantine after returning from overseas. An infected cleaner is believed to have passed on the virus to his or her large family, including a prison worker. Health authorities have been working to trace all known contacts of those within the Adelaide cluster. Thousands of people have been tested since it was discovered. Just one new case was detected Monday, but South Australian Premier Stephen Marshall says vigilance is needed.
This is a very dangerous situation. If we work cooperatively with SA Health and SA Police on this one, we should get on top of it. But it's really a very worrying situation and we must act very swiftly.
The state government has brought in new emergency restrictions in South Australia, including the closure of gyms, while international flights carrying returning Australian citizens and permanent residents have been suspended for 7 days. The outbreak could hamper Australia's efforts to reopen state and territory borders by Christmas. Western Australia, Tasmania and the Northern Territory are reintroducing quarantine measures on South Australian residents. But other jurisdictions, including New South Wales, have no plans to refuse entry to visitors from South Australia. New South Wales Premier Gladys Berejiklian.
What this does is reinforce for us how contagious the disease is and how unexpectedly cases and outbreaks can arise, but it's how you deal with those outbreaks. And we're confident that if that happened in New South Wales, we'd get on top of it, and similarly that South Australian authorities are getting on top of it, and that's our understanding from our health officials here in New South Wales.
New South Wales has recorded its 10th consecutive day without any community transmission of COVID-19, while Victoria state officials say they've now gone 18 days in a row without a new case, following the easing of a strict lockdown in the city of Melbourne. Since the pandemic began, Australia has diagnosed 27,750 coronavirus infections. More than 900 people have died. Australia closed its international borders to foreign nationals in March. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
With the world quickly approaching 1 year since the novel coronavirus emerged on the scene, VOA's Carol Pearson reports people are now suffering what's being called pandemic fatigue.
Throughout the world, people are tired of this pandemic, tired of wearing masks, tired of practicing social distancing, and health workers are tired too. Howard Catton is with the International Council of Nurses.
We're extremely concerned about the mental health impacts on nurses.
Nurses and other health workers stay with the dying when no one else can.
It's just hard to see somebody passing in front of your eyes.
Health workers have been putting in long hours since the beginning of the pandemic when people cheered their heroics. And now there's another spike. As the pandemic continues, people are having difficulty maintaining safe habits. That's because over time, as we adjust to a threat and stress levels drop, it's natural to let our guard down. But it's important to remember that while we may take a break on safety measures, COVID-19 doesn't. It keeps infecting people at markets, at demonstrations. COVID doesn't care about the cause or political affiliation. The World Health Organization urges global leaders to acknowledge the hardships people are facing. Dr. Ngozi Ezika is the top doctor in the state of Illinois.
I understand how pandemic fatigue is striking everyone. It's real. People are tired of not seeing their families. The way we work, the way we live, the way we play has all changed. And the harsh reality is that the sacrifices we've made and that we continue to make do not have a future expiration date.
Even with a vaccine on the horizon, experts say the only way to fight fatigue is with stamina. Dr. Scott B. is a psychologist with the Cleveland Clinic.
I call it willingness. Willingness to do uncomfortable things because we value them and deem them worthwhile, and they protect ourselves and those that we care about.
Experts recommend making safety measures like hand washing a habit. People can also reduce their risk while doing the things that make them happy.
Finding a new mask, something that excites you, a new social distancing activity, finding something novel and new is a way we excite our brains, and it's a way we can overcome fatigue.
Experts say if people are asked to be part of the solution, they'll cooperate more. It's worked to end other pandemics. It can work in this one. And someday the pandemic will end. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
Still to come on today's program.
The protesters are out there today because they really want to drive home their message that one of their core demands is constitutional reform.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
People living near the North and South Poles who look up to the night sky are often treated to natural light shows called auroras. Scientists say these shimmering waves of colored light are the result of the interaction of highly charged particles of the solar wind with the magnetosphere that surrounds and protects Earth. Auroras have also been spotted on other planets and moons within the solar system. After analyzing data gathered by the various instruments aboard ESA's Rosetta spacecraft, a team of scientists has discovered that the comet 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko has an aurora that glows in far ultraviolet light. The scientists found that the aurora is produced by solar wind particles interacting with gases that surround and radiate from the comet, known as a comet or tail. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. On Monday, Peru's Congress chose a caretaker president in an attempt to defuse a sharp political crisis after angry protests. Reuters' Brian Wood has the details.
Two presidents in Peru have stepped down in the past week, and a third was newly elected on Monday. Peru's Congress voted in legislator and engineer Francisco Sagasti as Peru's interim president to defuse a political crisis ahead of national elections in April. He is a member of the centrist Morado Party.
Por nuestro país.
For our country, for the young, and for a better future for all Peruvians, I swear.
Manuel Merino, his predecessor, resigned as interim president after just 5 days in office because of ongoing protests following the impeachment of former President Martín Vizcarra. Vizcarra was widely popular with Peruvians, but angered lawmakers for his anti-corruption measures. In the wake of an economic recession brought on by the global health crisis, Sagasti pledged to move the country forward after taking office.
The pandemic hasn't stopped. The economic crisis hasn't stopped. The problem of insecurity has not stopped. This is a moment to amend and to decisively advance towards a better future for all Peruvians.
But protests have continued. Opinions are divided over Sagasti's potential to lead the country. Some congratulated him.
I think that Sagasti is someone that gives democratic guarantees that can get a transition towards a new government that will be adequate.
While others called for justice for those killed, injured, or are still missing.
Frankly, it's the same rubbish. The mask has changed, but everything is all the same.
Sagasti is set to complete the current government's term that ends in July 2021. General elections begin in early April.
Brian Wood reports for Reuters News. Thai riot police fired a water cannon at protesters who tried to cut their way through razor wire barricades outside parliament on Tuesday as lawmakers discuss possible changes to the constitution. Protesters are demanding changes to the constitution drawn up by Thailand's former military junta. They also want the removal of Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha, a former army ruler, and reforms to curb the powers of the monarchy. Reporter Philip Sherwell is in Bangkok, and I got the latest from him via WhatsApp.
Sure, the protesters are out there today because they really want to drive home their message that one of their core demands is constitutional reform. The current charter is one that was drafted by the military and passed under the old junta in 2017. And that formed the basis for last year's elections, which the protesters widely claim were deeply unfair and which returned the former junta leader to power as a prime minister. Part of that constitution involves that a large chunk of the parliament are unelected senators appointed by the old military regime. So the protesters think it's a deeply unfair and undemocratic piece of paper under which the country is governed. And they say that no other meaningful changes can occur in Thailand without the constitution being revised. So they have been pushing for this. And today, MPs are sitting down to discuss a series of proposals for constitutional reform, have been discussing those. And the protesters really wanted to make their voices felt. There's quite a lot of controversy about how these reforms are being considered. There's reforms put forward by the government, which amount to little more than tweaks. There's quite dramatic reforms put forward by the opposition, which would involve a rethink of how the whole country is governed and even sort of reform of how the role of the monarchy. So there's a lot at stake, and the protesters were just determined that they wanted to make clear that they hadn't gone away, that their message was strong, and they wanted the MPs to hear them.
Can you kind of walk us through the process that's taking place in Parliament? Because as I understand it, this is the first of 2 days of discussions.
Yes, that's right. The Parliament has set aside today and tomorrow for this debate. The seven different proposals are being put forward. There is supposed to be a vote tomorrow. Things are very fluid at the moment. But it's quite possible that a number of these proposals will be picked up and taken forward by a charter review panel. Now, again, the opposition suspects and the protesters suspect this is a way just to kick the can down the road by the government and the ruling establishment, and to try and sort of divert attention by sort of saying, yes, look, here's a, you know, we're doing something, we're considering it now, could you go away and come back in a couple of years, which is the time period that some pro-government senators have given to review all this. So there should be a vote on Wednesday. We'll see if that goes ahead. I expect it will.
Philip, one last question. The protesters have been calling for changes to the monarchy, and you mentioned that the opposition was introducing measures about that topic. Is that being addressed directly during these discussions?
It is. Not directly, in the sense that some of the proposals for change basically talk for the whole of the existing constitution to be up for review. And that includes the clauses that affect how the monarchy governs, which are right at the start of the constitution. So there aren't sort of direct proposals so much as a call for a review of the whole constitution.
Philip Sherwell reports from Bangkok, Thailand. A Chinese official says Beijing is considering changes to Hong Kong's mini-constitution after imposing a series of moves tightening its control on the semi-autonomous city. Hong Kong's basic law was enacted after control of the financial hub was returned to China from British colonial rule in 1997. It was guided by the concept of one country, two systems that guaranteed the city an unusually high degree of freedom as well as an independent judiciary. The Chinese government approved a sweeping new national security law back in June in response to massive pro-democracy demonstrations. Blockchain technology has the potential to transform business in the banking, automotive, and government sectors. But there's also a potential generational gap. Young people interested in learning about the technology that underpins cryptocurrency transactions are discovering that educational resources are few and far between. That's why 19-year-old Ranuk Chowdhury decided to start Blockchains for Schools. VOA's Tina Trin has more. The future
consumerism. Ranuk Chowdhury noticed something right away whenever he attended blockchain tech meetups.
Everyone there was at least twice my age.
Blockchain is the decentralized distributed ledger technology that makes cryptocurrency transactions like Bitcoin run. It has major implications for banking and supply chain industries by reducing the need for intermediary parties. Tech giants like Amazon, Microsoft, and IBM are already exploring it, but it likely won't be mainstream for another 10 or 20 years.
At that time, you're not going to be the principal consumer. The principal consumer will be the adults of that working world, which are right now the high school and college students.
That's why the 18-year-old decided to start Blockchains for Schools. Blockchains for Schools connects high school and college students to the blockchain industry through mentorships and contests, like the Hack BFS Ideation Challenge. University of California Santa Barbara senior Alexis Delandes was part of the winning team.
I didn't expect it. I mean, we had a great team. We did a good project, but you know, it's always a surprise.
Delandes and his team came up with the idea for Easy Ether, a smart contract that prevents money loss when blockchain tokens are transferred from one digital wallet to another.
We won an interview with a Mozilla incubator, and if they like our project, they can invest more than $70,000.
Anthony Lusardi works at blockchain startup Digital Asset and is a student mentor.
It was actually really impressive because a lot of them came very prepared. They already had questions that they were going to ask, and they, you know, obviously thought through this a lot. The entire space has barely existed for 10 years now, and so that's about the amount of time it takes to become an expert.
When the technology is so new that no formal education exists for it, Blockchains for Startups promotes learning through doing. Tina Trin, VOA News, New York.
The World Health Organization's 194 member states have agreed to push for the global elimination of cervical cancer, a disease that every year affects 570,000 women and kills more than 300,000. Lisa Schlein has more.
Cervical cancer is a vaccine-preventable disease and curable if detected early and adequately treated. Health officials say the tools are available to eliminate this disease, the fourth most common cancer among women globally. WHO's three-point strategy calls for all girls to be vaccinated for HPV or human papillomavirus before age 15. It says women should be screened twice between the ages of 35 and 45, and those found to have the cancer should receive treatment. WHO's Assistant Director General, Princess Nothemba Simelela, says new technology based on artificial intelligence can be used to screen women for cervical cancer.
If these technologies are used, we would be able to get a diagnosis of cervical cancer within 15 to 20 minutes. At this point in time, turnaround from the laboratories can be anything up to a month or longer. And women don't get their results because most of them don't stay or live nearest to the facility.
Simulela says the rapid diagnosis will be a lifesaver for many women in developing countries. She says they will be able to be treated immediately on site for a precancerous condition without having to return. WHO reports sub-Saharan Africa has the highest number of cases and deaths from cervical cancer, followed by countries in Southeast Asia. Simulela warns cases and deaths will continue to rise in countries that do not invest in vaccines, screening, and testing.
The African continent is the only continent that will be reporting higher populations beyond 2030. So they'll be dealing with a double burden there, in that they'll have a bigger number of young people to get to with the vaccine and a larger population of older women who will be having cervical cancer, who have not been treated.
Cases and deaths in high-income countries are much lower than in low-income countries because of the wide use of the preventable vaccine, which can run as high as $110 a dose. Simulela says developing countries can obtain the HPV vaccine at an affordable price of less than $5 a dose through the Gavi Alliance procurement system. Gavi helps vaccinate children against infectious diseases. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by visiting voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States was the first nation founded on a commitment to universal rights for all human beings. The most fundamental of these rights, said Secretary of State Mike Pompeo during a speech in Indonesia, is the right to freedom of conscience, including religious freedom. America's respect for God-given rights is a defining feature of our national spirit, declared Secretary Pompeo.
It's why America stood tallest among Western democracies in supporting your independence from colonial rule and has been a stalwart supporter of Indonesia's transition to democracy over these past two decades. The fact that our people embrace freedom and uphold a tradition of tolerance is very special.
Embedded in Indonesia's vibrant democracy is a desire to see people of all faiths live together in harmony. This is reflected in its constitution, which clearly states that every person shall be free to practice the religion of his or her choice. As Secretary Pompeo said, there is literally no reason that Islam can't coexist peacefully alongside Christianity or Buddhism. Indonesia's traditional spirit of tolerance and pluralism must be nurtured now more than ever, said Secretary Pompeo.
Blasphemy accusations which destroy lives have become more common. Discrimination against non-official religions renders their practitioners second-class citizens who are subject to abuse and deprivation.
Secretary Pompeo went on to urge more religious leaders to speak out on behalf of people of all faiths, wherever their rights are being violated. We need more religious leaders to be a moral witness. One of those places is in Burma, where the military has violently oppressed Rohingya and other minorities. Indonesia has pushed ASEAN to live up to its humanitarian ideals, but progress on justice remains stalled, said Secretary Pompeo. But the gravest threat to the future of religious freedom, warned Secretary Pompeo, is the Chinese Communist Party's war against people of all faiths, Muslims, Buddhists, Christians, and Falun Gong practitioners alike. God-given, unalienable rights are the birthright of every people, said Secretary Pompeo. That's why free people of free nations